Hello, and welcome to the PharmaLex Talks podcast. My name is Chris Englerth, and today I'm speaking with Angela Vogt Eisel, Associate Director of Scientific Affairs at PharmaLex, a Cencora company. Angela, who's been with PharmaLex for more than 12 years, will be discussing the old and new environmental risk assessment guidelines and the challenges associated with the pharma package. Angela, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, certainly. Thanks for the introduction, Chris. Environmental risk assessments have been part of my work almost from day one in my PharmaLex life. And at first, it was quite a niche topic that got very little attention, and I could actually handle it perfectly well by myself. But with the ongoing developments, especially with the growing awareness of environmental issues with pharmaceuticals, the topic grew and grew, and by now we are quite a team of experts working on the subject together.
And first of all, as we get into this, can you tell us a little bit about the topic of environmental risk assessments? What's the situation and what are the real key issues at the moment?
Certainly. An environmental risk assessment, or ERA, needs to be submitted with every application for marketing authorization for a medicinal product. And by the way, this applies both to human and veterinary drugs, but we'll stick to the human ones for today. And it's also required for some variations if an increase in environmental entry is expected. So, for example, if you add a new indication and therefore your patient population increases. It basically consists in a set of defined ecotoxicological tests, some of which are quite costly, that you need to submit. And in the end, the agencies have this standardized set of data for each drug, or actually more specifically for each active compound that forms part of the drug. And the issue that we have is that no data are available for almost 300 currently marketed active substances, which is one quarter, as they entered the market before the ERA became mandatory in 2005. And now the trouble, of course, is that on the one hand, the environmental agencies are extremely keen to collect this information on the outstanding active substances, which are sometimes present in relevant amounts. And on the other hand, the companies are obviously not too thrilled to conduct these costly studies, especially when they have products where the margin is slim.
It sounds like that ongoing balance between ensuring safety and also making sure that we get the products out to patients who need them. Regarding the legal framework, can you explain the necessity of the environmental risk assessment, or ERA? We'll use the acronym as we go forward. Under the current directive, 2001/83/EC, and the plans for its revision?
Yes, so the necessity is put down in the current directive, but it's very vaguely defined. So it basically says that the ERA should be submitted in module 1.6, but there's hardly any additional information. And in contrast, the proposal for the future directive is much more detailed, and it really outlines the key facts that should be described and discussed. So one thing that is noted in the new directive is that information on environmental persistence and bioaccumulation potential should be described, because some compounds tend to accumulate in the food chain. Then another point is that the risk of antimicrobial resistance development needs to be addressed. And in this case, it's not only the clinical application, but they ask to regard the entire manufacturing supply chain, both within and outside the EU. And then one really big point is also that the impact on the endocrine system should be discussed. So hormones and hormone-like compounds tend to have effects even at very, very low concentrations. And the probably best known example is that trace amounts of oral contraceptives, so anti-baby pills, tend to end up in surface water. Patients excrete them, and then residual amounts end up in the surfaces and in the lakes and rivers. And the fish that are chronically exposed to these very low concentrations tend not to reproduce properly anymore, which is not surprising given the desired pharmacological action, of course, but it's like involuntary family planning for the fish. That's, of course, quite an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And one we need to make sure that we're addressing, and that's exactly the point of this type of regulation. So how does the recently published revision of the guideline on ERA for medicinal products for human use fit into the picture?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting question. So the detailed proceeding for the ERA is not defined in the directive. So the directive is quite top level and short, but there's always a guideline accompanying the directive that explains exactly how the different steps should be performed. And interestingly, the revision of the guideline already anticipates some of the upcoming changes of the new directive. So right now we've got the old directive and the new guideline, which is a bit of an intermediate situation. But in the new guideline, you already see the greater weight given to environmental issues and the particular topics of interest that are outlined in the proposal for the new directive. One point I would like to make, though, is that neither the new nor the revised version of the guideline foresee that environmental concerns, so actually the results of the studies that you have to submit, should prevent marketing authorization. And the idea behind this is probably an ethical consideration that no patient should be denied a safe and efficacious treatment based on such concerns.
So the regulation doesn't necessarily prioritize environmental protection over patient care. It's more about awareness and potential mitigation strategies necessary to address it.
Yes, absolutely. So actually, mitigation measures is also something that you should address in the future directive. In the current directive, this is limited to wordings in the patient leaflet. And from my own experience, I can say that most people don't read it all the way through and necessarily are very impressed by a statement, you know, like don't dump it into the toilet. So the new directive definitely encourages further mitigation measures, although this is not clearly defined. So far.
So can you get into an overview of these key changes in the revised ERA guideline?
Definitely, yes. At very first sight, the obvious change is that the new document is much longer. It's 64 pages versus previously 12 pages, plus another 17 pages by a questions and answers document. So it's a much longer document, and most people are, first of all, kind of intimidated when they look at it. But I must say it makes the document much easier to read and to comprehend because it adds much more context and explanation. It has little summary tables. It has little overviews and graphics explaining the process. So it's really much, much easier to follow the process. And another part is also that there is not so much cross-reference to external documents, but they really did collect all the relevant information and put it down in one place. So That's really nice. I'm a big fan of the longer version of the guideline. Then there's also a couple of formal changes. There's two decision trees to follow. This is not really a difference to the old version of the guideline in terms of content. It was basically the same sort of questions that needed to be asked, but now you've got it nice and structured, and it's a very defined proceeding going through these decision trees question by question. So I also like that one very much. Then there's several types of changes in the structure of the assessment, and that probably goes too far today because it's really the nitty-gritty detail on how and where the trigger values are for which study set. And sometimes there's a change in particular studies. I mean, if you're interested, the earthworm test used to be acute and now it's chronic. But this is probably going a bit far for this podcast today. The very biggest change is definitely the treatment of generics.
Yeah, we'll talk a bit about the treatment of generics and the changes, but it's really interesting to hear of something getting longer, but actually becoming easier to use.
Yeah, definitely.
Usually you think of a guideline or regulation getting longer, and that just means there's more added to it. But that's a great improvement, as you describe it, with the decision trees and the graphics to help make this easier to use. Let's talk about these changes for generics. Generics are a very important part of how drugs come to market and become accessible for patients. So let's talk about that. What are those big changes for generics?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. So generics have been in the previous version of the guideline in sort of a gray zone, so the wording was not very clearly defined, and there was a possibility to waive the entire assessment based on the argument that no net increase of environmental concentration of your active substance is expected, because as patients change from the originator to the generic, the same quantity will enter the environment, and therefore generic companies could just say, we only replace the originator, we don't need to conduct the assessment. And for a long time, this was, you know, easily accepted. But recently, and I would say during the last five to 8 years or so, agencies became more and more reluctant to accept this argument. And as the wording was kind of vague in the guideline, it was also possible to reject it. And likely this was because of what I said in the beginning, that in many instances, no ERA was performed by the originator, especially for old products. And so the agencies are really keen to finally collect these data. And I would suppose that this was the reason for this drastic change in policy, I must say, with the new guideline. The revised document says very clearly a full ERA is demanded for every single submission for marketing authorization. And it says explicitly, including generic, hybrid, and well-established use applications. So there is no secret backdoor to jump out of this assessment anymore. And given the large costs associated with the whole study set, this is a real blow for the generic companies, especially when you regard that the costs for a bioequivalence study in humans are lower. So we are really talking about a multiplication by a factor of 2 to 5, I would say, of the development costs.
Well, it's such a potentially challenging situation where this is for that informational element and the additional costs it can bring towards generics, which is often all about reducing costs for patients. Yeah. Is there any positive news for the generic companies with this this change?
Yes, there is certainly a silver lining on the horizon. So as I said, the revised guideline anticipates some of the changes planned for the new directive. But we should always regard it in the light of the proposal for the new directive, of course, that is also upcoming soon. And the new directive contains a very interesting section, which states that in order to ensure that ERA studies will become available for every substance in the market, so to bridge the gap of those missing 300 active substances, companies will be contacted according to a prioritization list and asked to perform the relevant study set, even though they are not filing for a new application for marketing authorization. And if several companies market the same active substance, they will be asked to join forces and conduct the study set together. So eventually, once all active substances are covered, a monograph system will be set up collecting all the required information. And by then, it's planned that generic companies can simply rely on the originator's data, so there will be no duplicate effort anymore. And then we'll have, I think, a very good way forward.
So this is a short-term situation looking to cover those missing environmental impacts from older products that will eventually catch up.
Yeah.
So can you give us an overview of the assessment process and help us understand these decision trees in the new guidelines?
Yes. The overall process is fairly similar between the two versions of the guideline. It is a two-phase process in both cases. And we always start off with phase one, of course, where as the very first step, the harmless compounds, so to say, are sorted out. So naturally occurring compounds such as herbal medicinal products or electrolytes, vitamins, lipids can simply stop the assessment without conducting any study, which also makes a lot of sense. So when somebody produces an isotonic sodium chloride solution, it's kind of obvious to everybody that you will need to do a lengthy risk assessment for such a product. Everybody else has to move on in phase one and will have to regard two parameters. And importantly, these two parameters are regarded independently of each other and are evaluated independently. The first one is the amount of the active substance expected to enter the environment, the so-called PEC value. PEC stands for predicted environmental concentration. That's a calculated value, a very simple equation to calculate this. And if the trigger value is exceeded, phase two testing will be required. And now phase two testing starts off with a set of 10 defined studies. And depending on the outcome, further tests may be triggered. And the difficult bit is that very often I'm asked for a worst case scenario. And this is very hard to come up with, because you definitely can expect the costs and the time for the first 10 studies, but you will never trigger everything else. But you can never know what will be triggered. So it can be different environmental compartments, either because the compound ends up in the terrestrial compartment or in surface water or in groundwater. And this is something you can just not know up front. So anyhow, what you know is that once phase two is triggered, at least 10 studies are due. The second parameter you have to regard is the so-called octanol water partition coefficient. This is an experimentally determined value, but a very small study to quantify the lipophilicity of your compound. And the idea is that very lipophilic compounds have a higher risk of bioaccumulating and of accumulating in the food chain. So if you are exceeding the action limit for this parameter, you have to perform another defined set of tests. It's the PBT testing, persistence, bioaccumulation, and toxicity. So your outcome in phase one really can be either you're lucky and you fall below both action limits, then you're done. You can be very unlucky and trigger both. Then you have to walk down both branches and perform both sets of tests, or you can just trigger one or the other branch. In itself, phase one is not a great commitment. The effort only comes up when either branch is triggered.
Well, it sounds like a good process and one that people or companies will be able to manage. I think the most important information that we can offer here is advice. What advice would you give to pharmaceutical companies to prepare for these new ERA requirements?
There's a couple of things one can consider. One point is that data sharing is greatly recommended and encouraged by the agencies and also put down in the guideline. So ideally, you can form a group and split costs with other companies who are marketing the same active substance. In practice, this may, of course, be difficult because typically such companies are your competitors. But on the other hand, I've seen several cases of successful consortia, so it's certainly something that should be considered. Then, of course, there are several ways to remain in phase one. And I just said phase one itself is no great deal. For example, if you have a rare disease, you can argue then that your patient population is small and the environmental quantities will therefore also be low and therefore fall below the action limit. There's particular calculations that you can perform. And then you can also replace studies by bibliographical data. But in both instances, both when you are discussing prevalence and when you substitute your studies with articles from literature, data quality is definitely key, so you must come up with a very reasonable publication. And in general, there is no one way to proceed, so you must always take individual factors into account, and therefore you very often start with a gap analysis to search for the best way forward for the individual client.
This is all great advice and certainly makes it clear that there's a need for some support in making these types of assessments that could be very helpful. I'd like to thank you, Angela, for sharing your experience and insights on the ERA guidelines. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today. We hope you found this valuable and can apply it to your business as you navigate this these new changes that are coming. PharmaLex serves the pharma, biotech, and med tech industries, guiding our clients through the entire product lifecycle, from early strategic planning, non-clinical and clinical, regulatory submission processes, and post-approval activities. Please make sure that you subscribe so you can join us for future podcasts. And just to be clear, the information provided during this podcast does not constitute legal advice. PharmaLex and its parent company, Cencora Incorporated, strongly encourage the audience to review available information related to the topics discussed during the podcast and to rely on their own experience and expertise in making decisions related thereto.